Hello and welcome to the next episode of Lost in Criterion. I'm John Patrick Owatari Dorgan, and with me, as always, is a man whose preferred way to travel is inside of a Boston bag for some reason.
I am the Adam Glass, and that's why they call me the carpetbagger.
Just like, you'd have to be such a contortionist to get yourself inside of a Boston bag. It's so small, but
I don't think I've owned a suitcase I could fit into for many, many years. And I've owned some pretty large suitcases.
The movie works. It's good. Like, but the one sort of technical detail that kept like throwing me through a loop was like, the only person I know who can fit inside of a standard piece of luggage who is not a child is my wife. Because that suitcase doesn't seem that big, honestly speaking.
He is pretty folded up in there, as we see.
And he's a fairly small man, but like nonetheless, it's still kind of like, wow, that's unexpected.
Also, according to the airport lady, he only weighs 168 pounds. Not a weight I have seen in my life for many years.
So. Junior high school.
Pat, before we get into the movie this week, I do want to talk about our Patreon. It's patreon.com/lostincriterion. Over there, for $1 a month, you can help keep us going and get access to bonus content.
Woo, bonus content.
Woo, indeed. We do a non-Criterion film over there each month. Our supporters get to vote on what we're going to watch from a list usually that I put together, but sometimes I let supporters suggest a list as well. It's always fun. Always fun to have that level of interaction.
Really,
with the
I mean, basically, any time a supporter makes a list that is halfway decent, there's a good chance it'll become what we do because they're usually better than what we come up with.
I don't think any of our supporters have ever tried to give me a list that wasn't already at least halfway decent.
Right.
No one's ever suggested something that I didn't add to a list of future lists.
Well, I mean, the thing is, right, is that like, you know, where you sort of are in an uncomfortable position of essentially having to make one whole cloth out of nowhere and be like, I don't know, something.
So every so often I get to say, well, a few months ago, one of our supporters suggested this, and then I can do it because I couldn't think of anything. The $1 mark not only helps keep us going, but also get you access to that entire back catalog and the new vote. So there's like 75 episodes over there that you can go listen to on movies as far ranging as Critters 2 and Dog Day Afternoon. Really, the yin and yang of film.
It's beautiful, really.
A little above that $1 mark at $5, we'd like to thank those folks on air. Thank you to our $5 supporters, Andrew Jarrett, Eric Coronado, Stephen Goldmeyer, and Chris Otto. Above that, at $10 and above, for folks who can afford it, we really like to thank them. And we do something pretty dang special. Pat makes a piece of art based on one of the movies we watched recently. I get it printed up on a postcard, write a little personalized thank you note, and get that mailed off once a month to our $10 and above supporters. And we'd also like to thank them on our thank you so much to Adam Speakerman, Nina Bojnak, Jason Westhaver, Patrick Yocko, and Tracy McGrath, our $10 and above
supporters. Yes, thank you so much.
If you'd like to see those postcards without committing to that $10 mark or buy past postcards, you can head over to redbubble.com, search for our store there, search for Lost in Criterion there, our store will come up. You can buy past postcards as postcards, greeting cards, stickers, a couple other things. Mostly it exists as a library of Pat's art, as a way for non-supporters to view them, but we do sell them occasionally, and greatly appreciate everyone who has purchased anything off that Redbubble.
If you see one you like, you should buy it.
Also, greatly appreciate anyone who's listened, who's supported us through Patreon over the years, and also, thank you for listening. Pat, this week we're continuing our way through the Three Colors trilogy with White. Last week we watched Blue, which was a pretty dour film, a blue film. One might say.
I mean,
but that actually
no, because doesn't that mean
that
like dirty?
yeah, blue films. Blue films are like blue comedy. They're adult oriented, so to speak. I meant blue like sad because it is a pretty melancholy film. But one would not qualify it as a blue film because that is a term that has a specific meaning. That is not what that movie was.
We should take it back. We're gonna take it back. We're gonna take the meaning of that phrase back.
I suppose we should. Each of the films is representative of one of the colors of the French flag, red, white, and blue. Or blue, white, and red, I suppose, given the order that the movies come out. Each one also is representative of one of the classical French Revolution ideals. Last week, blue was representative of liberty. This week, with white, we get equality. And our director, Krzysztof Kozielewski, is a little sardonic about his uses of those terms in his movies. We talked last week quite a bit about the inherent political nature of a work such as this, and how Kieslowski seems to have been rather insistent that he is no longer making political works. His documentaries early in his career were somewhat political, but only really in that they were looking at real people in a real system. This week, we get an interesting little bit in one of the bonus features where Kozielewski's longtime collaborator, screenwriting collaborator, Krzysztof Pisowicz, says that Kozielewski stopped making documentaries because he felt it was, I suppose, unfair to make real people the center of his narrative.
Right, like this idea that they deserve dignity, yeah, and that, like, and privacy, and right, like making them the center inherently sort of deprives them of that. It's an interesting concept.
Yeah, it's a very interesting concept. It's also very interesting that Piesowicz is much more upfront that he is still making political work with these movies particularly, but with all of his collaborations with Kozielewski. Still sardonically, certainly. To him, the use of liberty, equality, and fraternity here are digs at European ideals.
Well, it's interesting. It comes from a really interesting place, because you can see, like, I didn't check to see what year those sort of bonus features were recorded. But, like, yeah, he has a very, like, yeah, you know, sardonic is the right word. He's just very detached from, right? It's like very clearly at some point probably, yeah, believed that story. You know what I mean? Like he yeah, bought into it and may have even bought into it when he was making these. Hard to say a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Like both him and Kozielewski both make mention of a really, I think it's very fascinating, right? They talk about the idea that there's like some hope in it, and the idea that like look at how like striving the Polish people are for equality with their European partners. Look how much they like, how quickly they kicked it into gear and started, and like we're presented with a movie where like that concept is conflated with like corruption and like abuse,
yeah,
right? Like is like, oh yes, the entrepreneurial spirit, a movie about a person who does criminal activities to get revenge. Like, you, yeah, know what I mean? Like, it's like, yeah, and that's why I say it's a little hard to tell if they have or have not already sort of like realize that this, yeah, is bullshit, in the sense of like, well, within sort of the capitalist framework, people will legitimately, without being sarcastic, look at that kind of behavior and be like, oh, that's entrepreneurial spirit. That's like that go get 'em attitude.
Right.
And so it's like really, it can be quite difficult to tell, like especially when it was being made.
Yeah,
what the deal was.
His talking head segment is from 2011, presumably filmed for the
right. And so his attitude now is definitely like, yeah, that was a load of shit. Basically, we were sold a bill, yeah, of goods,
but not entirely.
No, yeah, not as much as like you or somebody, you know,
yeah,
you or I might say.
Well, it's not, I mean that he doesn't entirely view it as a bill of goods, right? I think my interpretation of what he was saying. He didn't use these words, but I feel like what he's getting at is that there's sort of a tiered list. Liberty only exists with equality. But equality, as he frequently says, humans aren't interested in equality. Humans are interested in equality, in saying they're interested in equality, but in action, they want to be more equal than the other guy. So he builds and says, fraternity is the thing he believes in and the thing that gives him hope. True equality can't be true without fraternity, without an actual care between people. And he may not talk about fraternity in that sort of term, but it's, you know.
I mean, he does make a statement that's pretty akin to that. It's not exactly that, but yeah. That's the vibe of it.
Yeah.
Sure.
Right. Right. What he means as the difference between equality and fraternity boils down to that fraternity is an actual camaraderie between people that does not put them in competition with one another. Last week we staved off on talking about the accompanying shorts until last, but actually I think the politics of this movie and the politics of Kieslowski in general are sort of encapsulated in the two documentarian shorts that we get.
Certainly
the
Faces one is very much like the seven women of seven different ages is,
yeah,
it's there, but it's less obvious. Talking Heads, on the other hand, is a classic case of, well, will you just let normal people say what they think about the world? They're going to kind of reveal some truths about the sort of inequality, right? And you know, especially in that one, they're talking pretty heavily about the idea of wanting to be represented, like to be able to participate in the structure of the government, right?
Right. And they're having this discussion in 1980 in Poland, right?
Right.
Kieslowski puts a camera, people on camera, says, what year were you born? Who are you? And what do you want most wish for? And the way people answer the who are you question is very different from person to person and very interesting. What do you most wish for? You're right. Most people are talking about,
they have basically two things, be nice to each other, be kind and,
right,
and decent to each other.
Yeah.
And then, and don't try to get one up on each other, but also that idea of wanting to be active participants in their government.
Right. Yeah. And then poignantly, we go from youngest to oldest as we go through this, even a literal baby is the first one.
Yeah.
Who, of course, does not respond to the questions.
It's wonderful. The baby who cannot answer is is such an amazing, yeah, because also it's the beginning and you don't know what's going to be happening. You know what I mean? Like, you don't understand the full, the gist of the deal yet. It's kind of in that way, it reminds me of in many ways, it is very indicative of where this is going to go. His career is going to go, because it's essentially a misdirect at the beginning, because you're not exactly a misdirect, but you don't know, well, this makes no sense. Why are you doing this? And it only makes sense as the thing develops. It's a lot of fun. It might be one of my favorite sort of short works that we've ever watched. I really enjoyed watching these people. This is a really odd thing to do, but kind of wonderful.
And then the final one, the 100-year-old woman who's what she wants out of life is to just live more, is a very poignant hope at the end of that, that I really love, because I'm sure he definitely could have found a 100-year-old person who says, oh, I'm done.
Well, he almost does, right? Because the woman who's recently widowed is fairly despondent, right? Only been 2 weeks, and she's like, what do I want? I don't want anything. She basically straight up says, I don't care. We don't know what's going to happen to her in the future, right? She's in the middle of mourning at that time. But it's just, he basically does find a person who's I don't care.
I'm done. I think seven women of different ages does mirror that for me, but also it's more in line with some of his documentaries that the bonus feeders talked about last week but didn't show us, like the hospital one that gets mentioned again this week, where it's insular. It's just looking at the system as it exists.
Right.
And here it's a very particular aspect of the system. Ballet dancers of different ages, formatted as different days of a week. But we see the different ways that the system is interacting with these people.
Right.
If we take the ballet instructors as the system, I suppose.
I think we're also meant to understand that the ballet instructors themselves aren't just the system. The ballet instructors themselves are also like a lot of these systems, sort of integral inside the system, in the sense that like they're not their decision making system and the way they act is not necessarily reflective of their personal choices, but rather just the way the system is designed to function, right? And as we get up through the ages, it gets sort of more authoritarian and demanding and more in a unequal. Like as our first instructor with the young girls is kind and nice to them, and as we get older, they get more strict and nasty with them, and like it gets more and more unequal as who gets to or doesn't get to like do stuff in the ballet, gets more extreme and the degree to which they're pushed. It is an interesting look at how these sort of systems work. It's just not as like Talking Heads is so sort of like kind of on the nose. It's like we just asked a bunch of people what they think, and boy, they sure all did say the same basic things. Basic ideas.
Yeah, I guess just having these two be the ones that are accompanying the quality film is interesting, because they're looks at ways in 1978 and in the wishes of the people in 1980 that Poland is not an equal place right now, right? And of course, even under pure communism, there are going to be people who are more talented at certain things, and therefore... In artistic endeavors, in engineering endeavors, in anything that takes whatever talent they have, there are people who should be doing those jobs.
Right. I mean, the biggest difference
who
we're talking
able
about
to do those jobs,
in pure communism would be the fact that like that wouldn't equate to like you living a better life or a worse life, right?
Big
thing here is that like Poland, like there's an acknowledgement kind of built in that like Poland is not what it's. Similar to sort of the indictments of Waja in like I forget what the name of that movie was, but an idea of like this is not what it's supposed to be. Like this system is not doing what's like written on the tin. Like that being said, like it's interesting because a decade and a half later, we have and whether they think so or not, whether Kieslowski thinks so or not. A decade and a half later is a movie about how this one is also not doing what's written on the tin. Like, not really, right? The Poland they go to is not an equal society. It's not a fair place.
Neither
is France, right? It's worth noting that, like, the France he's in when he starts is also the place, is the model of this idea is also a terribly unfair place, unequal, unkind place.
Yeah. And the economic disparity between France and Poland. And Carol is so grateful to be back in Poland that he kisses the ground when he's finally out of the suitcase. But he raises his eyes to heaven, thankful that he's back in Poland, and he's in a frozen dump of a... a wasteland of a frozen dump, right? Yeah.
It's really like... I was really kind of like, it's got two writers and they seem to, Kieslowski doesn't live long enough to have long-term reflections on the work that he made, the way that Pizowicz did. I can't say his name. I did not ever catch how to say his name properly, but you know, he seems. I don't know. Like he makes a lot of points that seem to be somewhat devoid of sort of systemic analysis in them. Like he makes some points about like how bad things are, and like he never gets to the point where he's like, yeah, but that's all because that's how this system is designed to function. Like that's how it works. Like you know, he kind of is talking about how people aren't, you know, somewhere reflective of the Talking Heads thing. About how people aren't kind to each other. They don't treat each other equally. Like they don't.
Yeah.
They want their cut a little bit more than everybody else's, and like all this stuff. And it's like, yeah, but like that's because of. Say it with me now. Like you know, it's like like it's sort of like he doesn't seem reflective, and we don't ever get to hear because we get Kieslowski like a year after it's over, right? Where he's sort of reflecting on the idea of like he's got this sort of he has bought into. The idea that's being sold, which is like this is a path for a new Poland, right? Like a new equally participatory in the EU. And like even the idea that both of them are still like positive about the idea that the EU is a positive enterprise. And I understand an idea that like a union of states that prevents war is a positive enterprise, but it's also highly exploitative of anything on its periphery.
I think... Right, and we talked about that last week. And I think that echoing what we said last week, I think our director and our screenwriter are hopeful of the ideals of the EU, of that equality,
right.
Of that liberty, of that fraternity. But given the nature of the films we're watching, they're also suspect of it, right? These are movies that
right, and
there's no getting around it. I joked when we watched Chungking Express that ultimately my takeaway from Chungking Express is that one had to give up being a cop in order to find love. And I thought about it watching this movie because Carol's journey is one from anonymity and nothingness, and he has everything stripped away. He goes to Poland, embraces capitalism, becomes so rich, but all as a means to enact revenge, which is empty. And any reason to get that rich is empty. And then he gives it all up. He goes back to even more anonymity than he originally had, because not only does he lose everything.
Yeah, now he doesn't exist.
Now he's dead. He doesn't exist. He's literally no one as far as the world is concerned, but he still has his human connections and, in fact, regains the only human connection he wanted.
Right.
That to his ex-wife. He even finds his old haircut again.
I do find it fascinating that his haircut shifts in line with the kind of man he is being. Is a fascinating thing in and of itself.
You know, so this idea that he finds peace, he finds love, he finds fraternity after giving up his capitalistic endeavor.
Right.
Of course, he leaves that capitalistic endeavor to his best friend, but and his other fraternal connections have benefited from that system,
right?
But or from his benefit from that system, but still.
Well, like, that's what I'm saying is that, like, I don't think they're fully at the time of making the movie fully committed to the idea that, like, this system is inherently, like, I don't know, evil. Like, that the system is, like, you know what I mean? Like, they are making a lot of statements about, like, these ideals and stuff. But, like, I don't know, like, especially when you pair it with their the documentary things that they have. I was, frankly, like, a little, like, sad and disappointed when we watched the documentary parts of it. Because I was like, oh, like, on some level, they do believe that this is, like, the way forward. Mostly stemming from the idea of democracy, right? Like, that's the idea that is, like, got them fired up. And a lot of people fired up. The idea that, like, I get to have a say in my government. But as they and every other person in the world has learned, like, democracy and, like, capitalism are functionally incompatible, right? They don't function together in any meaningful way other than one destroys the other, like, wholly and completely. And so, like, it's just interesting because they, like, in that documentary, like, you know, we see sort of, you know, I cannot remember how to say his name. This is going to kill me. Pizzix is, like, more along that line, but, like, he's an older man, and he has never seemingly gotten to the point where, like, yeah, like, the system itself is flawed and bad. Like, that's just the end of the...
Yeah.
This will never produce the outcome desired, or at least by us.
Certainly, these are men who recognized that the system in place in Poland when they were young
was bad. Yeah, absolutely.
Or when they were in their 30s, you know, it was bad. But Kozlowski does die at a time where he might still be able to believe that the coming of capitalistic democracy, neoliberalism, all of that rolled up, is raising people out of poverty, but is raising thousands of people out of poverty as it puts tens of thousands into more poverty.
Right, and the thing about it is, right, is that, like, at the time that he dies, that can be sold as growing pains, as, like, you know, that's right. The shock doctrine was sold. Is it like, well, you got to break a few eggs to make an omelet, was the functional argument of it. Like, and, like,
right,
we, you know, what we learn over time, and, like, lots of people could have predicted, it's not like it was a wholly unknown result, like, but right, like, right, the result right. over time becomes like, oh yeah, like, but the eggs, like, stay broken, and, like, more get broken, and, like, a smaller and smaller number of people actually, like, get to eat the omelet. Like, it's right. like, and so, like, you know, one only needs to look at the massive rise of far-right nationalism in Poland to see that, like, yes, the contradictions are there and, like, destroying everything, right? Like, they are doing there what they're doing right. everywhere else. And in many ways, without even the era of prosperity that you saw in, like, America and places like that, that resulted for a brief time as a result of all that. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't even have that going for it, really. Because, like, most people right. just didn't prosper ever in that process.
Right.
You know. So, I don't know. It's just kind of an interesting result because you're like, when you watch this, you're like, the movie, viewed in hindsight, gets way more, I think, extreme feeling than it is possibly at the time they're making it. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Where, like, you and I looking at it would go, like, wow, this is, like, pretty, like, against this system. Like, this is a pretty strong, condemnation of the system. Because
yeah.
we have the hindsight of saying, well, yeah, like, I mean, like, these things didn't get better. They, in fact, mostly got worse.
Right. Yeah. I don't know. I cannot believe that the story of a Polish man marrying a French woman who takes everything away from him, who he last sees before leaving Paris, right next to a giant poster for the movie Contempt.
Right. Well, yeah, I agree. Like, I'm just saying that, like, we have a real sort of, for lack of a better term, like, death of the author conundrum here. Because
right.
what they are saying in their talking head interviews is not in line with what the movie seemingly says
right.
to us. Which puts us in yeah. a really weird place because, like, I know how I read this movie. Like, I know I can guess how you
yeah.
read this movie, right? I hear it in your voice.
Right.
I hear what you're saying. And I agree with you.
Yeah.
This movie feels like it is saying, you know, but, like, I think the problem is what we're getting at here is that what you're talking about is a real thing in the movie, but they're talking about it in a way that this is a sort of temporary, like,
right.
negative attitude right. on sort of a, like, personal rather than systemic level. And,
yeah.
and I think that they haven't, like, taken it to its
except,
logical
except,
result.
Except, again, the way that's fixed in the movie is giving up capitalism. And the way
know,
that would be fixed
I
in
know.
Real life.
I'm just telling you, like, I know. But, again, the people who made the movie are on TV And both of them, even one of whom has like a decade of hindsight. Now, mind you,
yeah,
he's a lawyer, so whatever that, you know.
He was a defense attorney.
I know, but my assumption is that he probably was better off in the system at all times than yeah. other people. Like,
oh, yeah.
I think that's
almost
a fair,
certainly.
Like, you can just sort of, you, the way he talks, the way he says, like, we both know that he was doing better in probably both systems than normal people.
Yeah.
But, like, I'm just saying that, like, they both have this sort of, like, seemingly trying to make it to be like, well, if everybody would just be nicer to it, like a very neoliberal like conception of it. It's like, well, if everybody was just nicer to each other, it's like, yeah, but the system doesn't
yeah.
allow that to happen, right? Being nice to another person in this system is going to like is counterintuitive to your success. Like,
also maybe he wasn't a defense attorney, but anyway.
I don't know. I'm just saying, like, I don't know. I agree with you. That's why I mean, like, this movie, all things considered, as long as you just never show somebody those talking head interviews, it's a pretty
right.
great, like, could just be used for the kind of thing that you yeah. want to say.
Yeah. Okay, but even if this movie isn't metaphor for anything, it's still a fun movie.
Yeah, I agree.
I really liked it. Yeah. Yeah, it's... It is, there's a lot of good humor in this movie. I knew this one was supposed to be the lighter one. I mean, one, it's the white one among the red, white, and blue, and white is the lighter color. And that seemed probably to be a theme that we were going to roll in, lean into after how blue last week's movie was.
Again, not in the traditional meaning of that word.
again, in the melancholy sort of meaning of that word. But yeah, there's a lot of great humor in this movie. It's a really great, one of the bonus features has Kozlowski. There's one on each disc. It's called Cinema Lessons.
I missed that one in the first one. Like, I don't know how, but like yeah. I went through what I thought was all the bonus materials and I never saw it. And then,
yeah.
Like, so I did watch it on this one, but
actually, I don't even think this bit comes from the Cinema Lessons. I think it comes from the Making of White section. That's its own 15-minute video, where Kozlowski talks about how they're not going to be able to use white in the same way that they used blue for blue, because white, when talking about film, is the absence of color. So you can't really tint something white very well. You can't suddenly have a bright burst of white in a film. White is a background. It's decoration, he literally says. It's the snow. And sure enough, the white things we have in the film, we get one sort of fade to white with the memories of,
I think it's like two,
the
right?
Wedding.
Maybe two. Like they fade
yeah,
to white a,
there's
a couple
of
times, I feel like.
Yeah. They absolutely fade to white during the sex scene.
Yes.
As a metaphor for cum.
Yes.
And we get the bird poop at the beginning, which itself
is a fascinating idea about what
for ejaculate as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we get the snow and we get a couple other small things. But white is certainly not as defining of a characteristic of this movie as the blue was a defining characteristic of blue. And as I anticipate, the red is going to be a defining characteristic of red. But maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense that it's going to work that. I mean, like, red's going to be a lot easier to work with. I mean, like, white is quite present. Like, despite everything, white is very present in this movie. There
right,
is a
right,
lot
right.
of white in this movie. You talked about comedy a little bit earlier, and I thought that was one of the interesting things uh-huh. about this. It's like, it didn't really register. Like, obviously, I registered as being kind of a dark comedy. Like, that was not a problem.
Right,
like,
right, right.
I was fascinated because, like, he brings up Charlie Chaplin. And,
yes.
like, I would not have picked it out myself, but, like, and they're like, well, but not, like, duplicating it, like, not trying to be Charlie Chaplin. But at the same time, I was like, well, but actually, like, There's a pretty intense amount, like, you know, there's a bit of like sort of like Charlie Chaplin-esque both sort of like motions, yeah, like actions, as well as like Charlie Chaplin adjacent like jokes in here. Like, obviously it's not nearly as slapstick as something like Charlie Chaplin would do, but like there's a lot of like kind of like more like the subtler moments of Charlie Chaplin, like when he's like doing something that's kind of like blatantly silly to the audience, like why are you looking down the barrel of the gun kind of thing, you know what I mean, like the audience goes like, yeah, oh, this guy's a goofball,
right? Chaplin never would have done the suitcase sequence in the airport as we see it in this movie, because Chaplin wouldn't have spent that long of time off screen for a joke,
right?
But there's a lot of humor knowing that there is a live person supposed to be in that suitcase and seeing how it's treated in the airport,
right?
And then, of course, knowing the dramatic irony of knowing that these guys who have just unloaded the suitcase out of the back of their truck and are currently arguing over the take of how they're going to split whatever massive thing has to be in the suitcase because it's so heavy.
Right.
And then open it up and it's just a dude who they immediately beat up and leave. But yeah, there's a lot of humor in this movie. And there's a lot of there's a lot of dramatic irony in this movie.
Yeah.
I guess is what I was trying to say there. But yeah, it's just a fun, well put together, like last week's movie, Blue is a masterpiece.
Yeah, all of this being said, like,
yeah,
if you ask me which one I would rather watch, I'd rather watch Blue. Like, Blue is just a more emotionally, like, kind of engaging,
I think,
film.
Blue,
White is interesting. White is a good and enjoyable movie that has a lot of things to say. Again, hard to determine which things it's trying to say, all things considered, you know, concerning how much we have already debated about that, but
I think Blue's use of glass and screens and reflection made a much more visually coherent film from a film craft standpoint than we get here.
Yeah, I would agree. Yeah.
Again, the Kozlowski's own admission that he didn't really know how to use white in the same way that he had used blue plays out here. We see that it doesn't have as a visual an impact as Blue had.
Yeah, I mean, you can see, you can see attempts and like where he was going with it, but it sort comes, we just sort of at the end sort of have to say, like, well, this just isn't as beautiful of a movie. Just like plain and simple, it just isn't.
If Carol is a metaphor for Poland itself, in its relationship to France, and if it's his relationship to itself, his taking of the land, his buying it out from under his employers, and then instigating the threat that if they don't pay him more than he paid for it, which is still not as much as they're going to get out of it,
right? There's
10
a reason
times
why they
the amount he paid
it, because it
they're
is
going
still,
to make
10
times.
They're still going to make 10 times what he made off of it.
Right. But the idea that if they don't play his game, it just goes to the church.
Their like absolute resignation when they find out it's going to the church is like, where it's like, well, I mean, that's fucking impossible. We can't.
Not going to be able to get it back from the church.
Yeah, that trade only goes one direction here, so. Yeah, I thought that was really. I found that part really quite funny because it's like just their instant like reaction, like, ah, shit, the church. Well, we better buy it from him now, or else we're never going to see it.
Right. Yeah, but you know, the only reason that real estate speculation is something that's going to happen is explicitly IKEA is moving into Poland, right? And IKEA as the epitome of cheap mass-produced consumerism, it was already there in 1993.
Right. Yeah. Right? Well,
that's not it. It has maybe production-wise gotten cheaper over the course of the years,
But yeah, it's still there. I mean, like, still... you know, IKEA has long been the sort of like the global symbol of like mass market like consumer goods, right? In a lot
right.
of ways, it's
right.
I you know, it's yeah, it's just interesting because like he's buying these people off his because like you know we. And again, the movie sort of only glosses over, only sort of like tangentially touches on these ideas. But like, you know, when we consider the fact that like, well, okay, why are these people willing to sell to him? And like the straightforward yeah. answer is like they have none of the thing that now makes the world go around, which is money. Right? Like they're like farmers. They live out in the middle of nowhere. They're not basically somebody's come along and said like, oh, there's this new thing. Where like co-capitalism, you need to participate in it. And yeah. It's like, well, how do I do that? And the answer is like, I don't know, fucking figure it out, man. Like, and so you have these people who are willing to sell to him because it's like, well, you need to be able to participate in a fast way to like the one thing they have is the land that they've lived on, right?
Right.
And like
the
they're not actually going
to
be able to participate.
The particular farmer we
in
see
it.
Him talk to. The particular farmer we see him talk to doesn't even know what to do with the money. His dream is that it would be fun if he buried it in a jar. Yeah, yeah.
That farmer turns into a very endearing character because of stuff like
he really
that.
Does.
He's like, do you want to like sleep here? Yeah. I mean, you technically own this place, so
right, it's your bed now. So
yeah, that's very yeah. funny. But it's just like this sort of thing where it's like he. He has functionally sort of has no concept of like money and how and its relationship to like him and how this is going to work, right? Like, not really.
Right.
Like, he kind of does. He knows he needs it, but like,
right.
he doesn't understand how much he needs, like, what to do with it, how it's going to work.
Right.
Because, you know, presumably he has been working this land his whole life. And,
right.
like, well, like, he doesn't even really have a conception of like what he's going to do when that's over, right? Like when he's not, because like he's not going to be working it after now that it's sold, right? Like I don't know. It's just fascinating that the movie doesn't fully engage with it, but like the idea that like yeah, you know, he's buying this land to like use in this plot, but like the person he's buying from it is going to like in the end we know going to suffer for not having it, right?
Right.
And the people, and you know, Carol can make enough money to accomplish his goals off of selling it. I don't know. It's just puts us as the audience, like, especially again, it's sort of in a reflective sense, like in a position of going like, yeah, okay. Like this guy's got money. Like, is that enough money now to like start a new life in this new world? Like, I don't know. Probably not, but maybe.
Maybe. Yeah. You know, they talk in the bonus feature. I think it's the screenwriter talking about how, you know, everyone was just aggressively out to make as much money as possible.
Right.
But also not everyone, right?
Well, yeah.
We,
no, they
we not
absolutely,
only see
yeah,
one
they,
character
a,
in this movie.
Yeah,
not.
Yeah.
But... You know, it wasn't the advent of capitalism did not change everyone's lives or everyone's motivations because there's still plenty of people who were living a subsistence living, or if anything, got a little worse.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's like it's in actuality, it did change their life. It changed all their lives, but the difference yeah. is like those people who were able to have that sort of subsistence living. Based on the land they owned and things like that, or the land they worked because they, you know, but like,
right,
didn't
right, right.
like things didn't get better for like, if you didn't like go out and grab that bag immediately.
Right.
My guess is your life got probably noticeably worse, like over time, because like, think about what that, like that guy, if you really think about that guy, right? Like he's got to go off and like use that money that he just got that like, most of the people wouldn't get necessarily.
Yeah.
Go off and use that money to do something, right? Like to turn it into more money, right? Yeah, maybe he's going to go just get a job. Does he know how
right.
to do anything? right. other than Fawn.
Well, he's going to move in with his son.
Right. I guess that's true. I forgot that that's mentioned in there. But it's just thinking about like how, they're like, everybody like kicked it into high gear and started like participating in this capitalist system. And it's like, but like there's probably a lot of people who did it and that much to their detriment. Right. In fact, we know.
Right.
And even people who tried, you know, this system doesn't work where everybody wins. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
Even of those people who all kicked it into gear, some of them lost. Probably most of the Carols and, actually lost. Let's be really clear.
Right. And again, we even see Carol himself give up that money. Literally, he gives up his lucky coin, throws it into the coffin before they nail it up. But also gives up that those riches by giving up his life, right?
Right. So in that way, somehow, like, we also see that, like, Carol in some ways is not a full participant in this system, right? Because what he does is antithetical to the way this system is designed to work, right? Like, you're not supposed to, like, give that up.
Right.
And in that way, he is a sort of failure. Like, he's not fully bought into the system as it is designed to function, right? Which is kind of fascinating in and of itself.
Yeah. And Michelage, who is similarly someone who's moved to France to try and find a better life, seemingly, all of his despair is wrapped up in not having any friends. As soon as he has a personal connection with Carol, he's no longer suicidal, right? It's not... It doesn't happen until Carol very overtly shows that he does not want Michelage to die in a very dramatic way, right?
Yeah.
But still.
Very filmic, right? Like, the movie gets very... There are elements in this movie, like, they talk about this in the description, you know, the sort of, like, the behind the scenes, like, well, we can't just make normal life because normal life's boring. And I agree to disagree, nonetheless, like, the the result is, like, things that are remarkably dramatic happen. Far and above what normal people would be engaged in, right? Like, this plan to convince your friend to not kill himself by, like, shooting a blank at him is great film, I guess, you know what I mean? Great fun on film.
Well, you know, it allows him to have the thrill and the fear of facing death. And then realizing, wait, I don't actually want that.
Right.
in a way where he can actually come back from it, right? Yeah. Normally if you're wanting the release of suicide, you don't get that second chance. So
I'm just saying that this movie does not purport to be very realistic, is all, and it is not very realistic to to actual life in that way.
So
in a lot of the sort of economic conditions, sort of discussions and stuff, even in there, it's probably not all that realistic, just because like these kind of harebrained schemes work. Rather than just getting the person killed.
So we get in Kozlowski's cinema lesson, we get him talking about how the opening of this film was changed from how it was originally scripted. We don't get explicits to how it was originally scripted, except that the change involved intercutting the suitcase into Carol arriving at the courthouse. And the foreshadowing of having the suitcase there. We also get from some of the other bonus material information that the end of this movie changed from how it was originally constructed.
Well, we get a lot more details about that too. Like, that's a lot more clear, and it's like, you know, some of it's more clear than others. Like, we do come to understand that, like, originally it's supposed to be kind of an accidental thing that she ends up in jail.
Yes.
That's mentioned. That seemed to have been scrapped relatively early.
Yeah. And then shot, but edited out, is Carol feeling regret that this plan is in motion once he sees that she's crying at his funeral, indicating that she does love him already. We don't get any of that regret in this final cut, but
well, I mean,
the entire ending sequence, the ending sequence of her in the prison is shot months after principal filming had closed.
Right. I mean, we don't get the regret that there we're talking about that exactly that we're talking about
right,
here.
Right, right, right.
But like, we do see him at the funeral and, you know, we do see his sort of engagement with that. And like, he seems like there's, you know, obviously we're just reading the emotions on the person's face, but like it comes off as
right
as somewhat like not maybe like remorseful, like kind of like a little bit like torn on whether this is like what he really wants to do or not. And then certainly we see him visiting, you know, the as you mentioned, visiting the prison and like
the prison.
It's and like our directors and everybody sort of agrees that like that is a sign that like, well, this has rekindled the love they have for each other.
Right.
Which I think is a scary idea. These people who hurt each other a lot are still in love, and then presumably are going to get back together after one of them gets out of prison. Is I don't know. Maybe I guess at this point they'll be on more equal footing with each other because they will have both hurt each other pretty dearly. But I don't know that that's going
right.
to result in positive relations going forward. But that's just me.
Well, now that he's officially dead, he's no longer wanted for arson in Paris.
That's true.
So
I guess they can go back to Paris.
All right.
Yeah, it's just a,
they're free.
It is an interesting. I guess it is part of the unrealisticness of the sort of like the way the movie is plotted that like this is like that in the eyes of the people who made the movie, like this is a positive final development. You know what I mean? I don't know. I explain what I'm trying to convey here, but like, I'm like, I don't know if this may not work out so good. But yeah, no, I do like the ending of the movie though. I think it is,
yeah,
it's good. It conveys a lot of really powerful emotion. It in some ways is possibly a little out of line with the rest of the movie in the sense that like what is a relatively goofy movie gets a little bit heavier there at the very end, a little bit more serious about what it's trying to emotionally convey. I don't know, it's not bad or anything like that. It's just sort of like, oh wow, we kind of like decided to be really more engaged with their feelings than we possibly have been throughout the movie. But
it does also make the ultimate point of the movie in the same sort of tongue-in-cheek way I've already established. Poland has to reject capitalism, and France has to go to prison for a while.
I mean, I think that is a valid argument that you and I can make that is not what the movie is trying to say.
Yeah.
Like, I agree, like, in our final read of the movie, because, again, we have, like, a lot of hindsight and everything like that to afford us.
Right.
Like, I agree that, like, it can be really easily understood as a condemnation of this system. That this system is flawed and will never achieve the goals that it purports to have, and will, in fact, just extract from people until they die. Like, this is what it's going to do.
Right.
But, alas, I don't think that's the point they're trying to make. Sorry to say.
I am also sorry to say.
I agree that France should definitely go to jail for a little while.
Listen, I don't believe in prison.
Well, no. I don't believe in prison for
people. But the nation of France. Yes, but the nation of France.
I fully commit to the idea that a country, minus the people, could go to jail. Like, oh, France, you're just not allowed to participate in anything for a while.
France as a concept needs to be put on hiatus.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. And I think large portion of Northern Africa would agree with us.
Yes. And it's not France isn't the only country.
Oh, certainly not.
Most of Europe and the US. All of the Commonwealth. Just step back.
You guys are on timeout for the next 200 years.
If we're going to,
you're not allowed to do things.
Reach equality. if we're going to get to that fraternity, gonna have to just not do anything for a while.
And like, you know,
just leave.
I will agree. Like, you know, this movie and Blue really do present you with a real problem, us with a real problem, which is like the movie, from my perspective, definitely is saying that like those ideals are not compatible with the system that you actually have here. Like the way things actually work is not compatible with the things you like that are literally written, like they're not literally because they're not, but like, you know, that are like the three ideals of the revolution are like completely at odds with the actual world you built. But man, the movie makes it hard to make that. Like they sure keep just sort of pulling the rug out from underneath us on that.
Yeah. Stuart Clawins writes the essay for White, accompanied with the Criterion release. And he opens with an anecdote that Kozlowski, in 1989, just months before the Berlin Wall fell, was in Montreal as a member of the jury of the Montreal Film Festival. And an interviewer asked him to discuss politics, or when he would discuss politics in his films, I guess. And Kozlowski's response was, "The day I can buy toilet paper in a Polish store, I'll discuss politics." Which, he's shutting down the question, right?
Right.
But pointing out that through the 80s, Poland has become even more disequal to the rest of Europe, right? Things are really bad in Poland in 1989. I think we've talked about 1980 and the Solidarity Movement and the totalitarian aspects of communism getting real down in there for a while.
And just the way that all those regimes responded to like this displeasure and unrest was to like go more authoritarian,
really crack down.
Yeah, like they don't ever respond with like, you know, maybe we should like make a good faith effort to make things better for people. Nope.
Oh man, the people are against us. The people must be wrong.
Right.
Yeah. That's the
now, mind you. Later on, that's the real. We get into well, that's also the inclination of modern capitalist governments too, which is unfortunate. Both ends suck.
Right. That is the only time where horseshoe theory is free. It's true, is that the people in power in both
will always respond to retain this that in power. The same way. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And hey, that's why I'm an anarchist. But we won't get down that road today.
We can talk about whether or not systems built in like whether or not socialism in one country was a good idea. I will engage with that notion.
Yeah,
really freely. I am not a Stalinist. Let's be very clear.
Yes. Anyway, if with Kozlowski's response being "the day I can buy toilet paper in Polish, I'll discuss politics," Klawin's essay uses that as a bouncing off point to recall that in this film it is said you can buy anything in Poland now, and then Klawin's approaches everything on the level as Kozlowski still not talking about politics, which again I don't buy.
Right. Well, you know, Klawin, I didn't read the essay, but the on White thing that came with this is in a similar vein of like just kind of refusing
that's
to
Tony Raines.
Yeah, refusing to take a critical lens to the whole thing and being like, just taking exactly what they're both saying in those interviews and stuff at face value completely with no sort of no consideration really.
Which is weird for film scholars to do.
Yeah,
I really think.
It feels. I don't know. Yes, but I'm going to make an argument that is my go-to. It's a perennial favorite. These film scholars exist in a context, and that context is one where they believe that the system itself is good.
Fair,
and that like. The way that we distribute wealth and and like sort of like success to people is good and fair and equal. Yeah, yeah, you know, it is a very if you believe in the system, which lots of people, yeah, many people do, and somebody tells you that their movie or whatever is identifying flaws in the system, but like is not a condemnation of the system, you're just gonna, mm-hmm, believe them. You're gonna say, okay, yeah,
yeah,
that checks out. You believe what I believe, that this system is, on its core face value, good, and that like, why read further? Why examine more critically when everybody's already on your side?
There is a line from Koroneko that is going to be stuck in my head forever, because whenever we talk about something like this, it pops back in. Why would anyone hate the samurai?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's that same.
Why?
Like, well, I know the system.
Why would anyone question the system?
So like, yeah, if I know the, yeah, system's good and is like beneficial to people because I have been told and also mostly reaped the benefits of it. Like,
right.
You're not even going to identify what level of sarcasm is present in that statement in somebody, yeah, making this kind of work, right? Even if they're not fully committed to the idea that the system is like beyond repair, like totally, you like just not viable, there's still sarcasm in here built in of like, well, this system is not doing what it's supposed to be doing.
Right.
And like, you're just going to like gloss over it because it's just easier. It's like, well, yeah, but like they said it's good. Why would I dig deeper or consider it further?
And Carol doesn't make any of his money from legitimate business. Carol makes his money from pure capitalism.
Well,
black market.
Right. Well, that's kind of
intercepting deliveries.
That's what I was kind of getting into earlier, is that like, think about it this way. Yeah. I mean, like, Carol is the most true of businessmen, right? Like, he has inserted himself as a middleman, yeah, without anybody's consent, basically, into the system.
Right.
And like, the thing about it is like, what I was trying to get at before is like, when you look at the screen and say, this is the entrepreneurial spirit, this is what we're talking about, this is like the real go-getter attitude of like, of Polish people in response to hardship, right? And then your entire movie is about a person who is doing crimes to accomplish his, yeah, goals. Like, you've got one of two choices. You're either being sarcastic, okay, or you believe, you look at this and you say, yes, this is capitalism, which is true, right? Which is the accurate representation of what it is. But like, kind of rendered into its sort of most sort of pure form. And the thing about it is that it is not an uncommon thing to encounter people pointing out what is essentially crime and saying, yeah, this is like the, like, pull yourself up by the bootstraps, go-getter spirit, right? As long as it's being done by the right people at the right time in the right way.
Right.
Right?
Like, and as long as it's being done for it. Right. As long as it's being done fantastically.
Right.
Like, Carol has built this empire of black market goods and Michelage with him. And when it comes time to fake Carol's death, the suggestion that they would murder someone, the unspoken suggestion that they would murder someone to get a body to replace Carol, is immediately disregarded. You know, that's not a line they would ever cross. To get an organization the size they have in an environment like 1993's Poland,
right? The amount of violence
there are already so many
done.
Bottles.
Yeah, there's so many bodies. And so in that way, right, it creates a fantastical universe, right? It is
right.
A common thing, you know, like the sort of like noble criminal myth sort of ideas and stuff. This idea,
yeah,
like, well, but like, I wouldn't kill anybody. It's like,
right?
You've described as an impossibility. You've actually described a paradox, basically.
Right. And the equation of capitalism and criminality has a long tradition in the films we've watched,
right,
for the Criterion Collection.
Bearing in mind, like, any critique of capitalism is going to have that built in as well. It's like, well, this system is
right.
going to have to kill people
yeah.
to do what it does. Like, it just has
right.
to.
Right. Because capitalism is also built on the bodies.
Right.
Right. Yeah, it's bodies all the way down. The blood of the worker, or the enslaved. You know what's, you know.
Well, and like and a valid argument being made throughout sort of, you know, Marx's writing and stuff is that way. I mean, like there's that's a in some ways can be understood as a distinction without meaning of like, you know,
right.
Like
right,
at what at what point do the wages reach such a low level that like there's no, you know, never mind the fact that like do you have a choice of whether or not you participate in the system at all or not? It's
right.
A lot of conversations that happen around these ideas, but like,
Would we feel better about Carroll's rise in economic prosperity if explicitly his organization was shown to be a functioning co-op?
Yeah, I was going to joke about the same thing. I was like, what if this is a crime co-op? What if everybody participating
everyone does
owns
seem to
equal
want to work
shares
there.
In the? I mean,
yeah,
it's fascinating because we see Carroll as a very genial person, right? He seems to be well liked by the people with whom he is working, but as you said, it's functionally impossible that he has accomplished what he has accomplished without like leaving bodies behind. It's not
right.
That's impossible.
Right. But this is a movie that wants us to believe that it is possible for the sake of Carroll still being a good guy.
Right.
Right. Which is fine. You know, narratively, that's fine. It's just an aspect of unreality within this film. And if we were to engage with the reality, or to if the movie were to engage more realistically with that, it would inevitably be even more of a critique of the West.
Right. I mean, like what you're resorting with is like what we actually have here is like, well, this is essentially has the mental aesthetics of a romantic comedy, right? Like don't look at any of the pieces too closely because it will fall apart if you analyze it too closely, right? If you pay attention to what's going on too carefully, it will disappoint you, right? You will see that the pieces don't actually fit. Like the system, like the puzzle is these pieces aren't even from the same puzzle, you know? And so it invites you to just like gloss over it, which is fine for a romantic comedy. It is, it's fun. It's functionally fine. It's just that like,
right. Ebert calls this an anti-comedy. And it is an anti-romantic comedy in that this is, instead of the hate each other so much that they fall in love of many romantic comedies, particularly of the 90s for some reason.
I think there was a really really fucked up conception of what love was in the 90s. A real conception of like, well, love is just when you hate each other enough that like, you can't help yourself or something.
That you can't help but kiss. This is revenge as reconciliation, which is an absurdity, right?
Right.
It is
right.
But it is an absurdity that is often the view people have of justice. That you're going to punish the oppressor into being equal. It's like, no, we're going to build a world. but yeah, so it's, I don't know, in that regard it falls to neoliberal critique of international justice.
Right. It does have a sort of fundamental flaw that like, well, it does and it doesn't, right? It both does for sure and also kind of doesn't, in the sense that like there's a fundamental concept, right, that like a misunderstanding of what justice means. It's like, well, it'll be revenge, right? It will be revenge.
Right.
One of the things that makes this a little bit different and interesting is that revenge doesn't tear them apart but makes them closer, which is just like not a thing that anybody thinks.
Right.
Like on
a core level,
neither side believes that is what's going to, you know what I mean? Like no sides in any debate about justice and like reconciliation and stuff like that believes that we'll do a whole bunch of crimes back and then also we'll all be friends when it's done, right? Like that's a functional absurdity, right? Like nobody believes that.
Yeah, but it is the absurd description that the establishment might throw at someone like Carlos, who we just watched the movies about.
I mean, the biggest difference is that, like, but their critique always ends in, and then we'll all be dead or enslaved.
Right,
you know what I mean? Like, they never take it to, like, an extra step of, like, and then, of course, after that's over, we will have been reconciled. Because, like, they're never going to take it to that, to there, because that even in and of itself sort of undoes the narrative of, like, well, the idea of people getting, like, any sort of reparations or something is inherently, like, dangerous and evil to us as a community.
I think there no doubt exists a class of white liberal infested with white guilt who believe that white people need to be imprisoned in order to be reconciled, because they believe in a carceral state to begin with.
You're right. That person definitely exists. Yeah. I am fascinated by the idea of that.
And we joked about it already
in
this episode, right?
That the idea of that person is really fascinating. Just this person is like, we need to be like thrown in jail and like and or killed, but we'll deserve it. And also that will reconcile everything. That'll fix.
Right. That'll make everything better. It won't. You can't actually imprison your way out of oppression.
Yeah, you can't, there's a lot of things you can't do that are antithetical to each other. You can't also murder your way to peace and quiet. Like, it just doesn't.
Right.
These things aren't compatible.
Sadly. Wait, no, not sadly.
If only things work the way that everybody seems to think they do.
Listen, I'm glad they don't, but also I just wish people stopped thinking that they did. So, yeah, that actually comes back around to another thing that Piskowitz says, that I'm landing on him not necessarily having his own coherent worldview.
Yeah, I mean, like, he struck me very much as a person in turmoil. Like, he is suffering from the contradictions, right? Like,
right.
He was sold something. He was told that this is how that things were going to work out a certain way. And it's evident. It's like clear as day that they have not, right? And so everybody, he's going through a process similar to what lots of people have gone through over the last, like, you know, 20 years or whatever, which is like trying to reconcile that's these irreconcilable situation, right? Where it's like,
yeah,
like, and like, he's old enough where like he can't, and he's been involved in this, like, because bear in mind, if he was the kind of person who like believed the sorts of things that were being that they were saying in the Talking Heads video, where it's like, well, we need like participation. We need like, and like these come as a set, right? Like the West says these come as a set, that you get democracy and capitalism. They are a pair, right, wholly inseparable from each other. We cannot have one without the other. And so that's what you're given, right? Like that's what you get, right? When it's like, okay, well, we're not in the communist system anymore. This is what we're going to get. And like, well, that doesn't pay what it's, that doesn't result in what it's supposed to result in, right? And so I think for people of a certain age, especially, who spent a long time in places like Poland dreaming of the time when they would be free to participate in their government, that reconciliation might even be more difficult than it is for somebody who just grew up in like us in the system beginning to end. You know what I mean? Because it's like, this is the thing you dreamed of. And it's wholly not what you wanted, right? It's completely and utterly not the thing you thought it was going to be, right? It doesn't do what it's supposed to. It doesn't help people the way you thought it would help people. Like, you get to vote, but you get to vote on who's going to pick your pocket more. Like, it's like,
yeah, he explicitly says in his bit in the bonus features that part of the point of these movies is to question whether or not autonomous decision making within plethora of consumerist goods is actually creates freedom, or just the illusion of freedom. You know, the choice between 20 different breakfast cereals.
Right. And my only real issue with what he is saying is that he seems to believe that like freedom and we talked about this, like, that it's always an illusion that like people don't want to be free. And I don't buy into the argument. I think it's that you have never been offered actual freedom. You've been offered what liberal governments say is the concept of freedom, but it's not we talked about this a lot last week. The idea is what she imagines freedom is deranged.
Right.
It's not, it's not real. It's not that you can't be free and that you can't freedom itself is an illusion. It's but you're just not being offered freedom. You're being offered a bunch of things that you're told are freedom instead.
Right. Yeah. Last week, the point of the movie was very obviously and inarguably not just our interpretation that there is no freedom in solidarity, or there is no freedom in solitude, only in solidarity.
Right.
You have to have those human connections.
He sort of seems to at times withdraw from that idea into a more melancholy sort of there is no freedom sort of idea. And I don't think not what his movie himself is even saying. And that reeks of sadness and stress and resignation that the things he thought were going to be good and helpful have not been. Right.
Yeah.
It feels like a person who's really he looks visibly sad throughout the interview.
He does.
The man seems so sad. And I have to read it as he is going through, especially being asked to engage with these movies he made, go through and talk about the idea that those contradictions are clear to him and to everybody.
Do you think he's extra sad that if this was filmed in 2011, it is most likely filmed directly for the Criterion Collection, and the Criterion Collection is a thing of commodifying art, of consumerist enterprise? Is he extra sad that this movie particularly, which has something to say about consumerism and consumption, is on the precipice of being marketed as being consumable? Is he just sad about the inherent contradiction of that?
It might be. I suspect that I don't remember. I can't honestly recall what 2011 Polish politics were like. But I would imagine it's probably mostly at that point, this has been going on for three decades or two decades? And things haven't gotten market. You know what I mean? I'm sure that might be part of it. I just think it's also probably there's no way that
I think it's more right.
You look at the world around you and you say this didn't. This is all. Yeah. This is not going the way we thought. You know, and in some ways you're being asked to talk about a movie you made that is at least somewhat hopeful about the future. Now you're in a state of reflection rather than a state of looking forward. You're that didn't. Well, that stuff didn't pan out the way we thought it was going to pan out. And that's a very depressing thing to be asked to think about.
Yeah. I also think one of his inherent contradictions to the things he says is just his idea that he seems to believe that it is human nature to want to be more equal than the next.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. And I was sort of responding to that. I forgot exactly what he said. But yeah, there's definitely an idea that in his mind that this is baked in and that the unfairness is an expression. And that is a classic liberal talking point, the idea that the idea that man is our beasts who will tear each other apart if not regulated by by governments and stuff. And this idea that we're animals that will rip each other to shreds to just steal and take whatever we want doesn't reflect, is a construct that was built long, like, you know, was built during the Enlightenment and stuff of, like, well, we need to, you know, when you talk about building, like, the idea of, like, social contract theory and stuff, like, you have to take his first principles, like, well, yeah, but without it, we'd all be tearing each other to shreds, like, which isn't reflective of what we know about places, like, human nature and stuff, actually, but it's a good narrative to explain, like, right, why we all have to submit to this doctrine, because if we don't, it's chaos, and it explains why we get to keep increasing police budgets and stuff. It's like, well, but, like, if we let people be who they want to be, who they want to be is a monster that kills each other. It's taken as understood that, like, the native state of humans is like cannibalistic animals or something. And that's why we need more police.
Right. Of course. That's why we need the National Guard.
Yeah, that's why the National Guard need to check people's bags at Grand Central Station for some fucking reason. Because they're all animals, yeah, who will tear each other apart if we let them.
Right.
The thin khaki line? I don't know. The National Guard doesn't wear blue.
No, they don't. I was suddenly reminded of a time where I was yelling at National Guard troops on the streets of Columbus that it's not too late to get another job. But anyway.
I've always wondered about National Guard because it does, like... It's a really strange, in my mind, strange nexus in the sense that, like, you signed up for the army, but, like, on the premise that you probably thought you weren't going to have to do any armying.
Right.
Like, to me, that's a very strange mental space to exist in. It's like, well, yeah, but, like, I'm not going to have to, like, actually go kill people, right? Like, I want to join the army, but, like, I don't want to do the army because, like, you could just join the army and go do army stuff. Like, they'll take you.
Well, you remember the National Guard was being marketed as a resume builder for most of
my life. Absolutely. This idea that, like, it's like, do you want to join the army that, like, gets you a better job but, like, doesn't require you to actually kill anybody? Now, mind you, for most of our lives that was the argument, and then they're like, but, like, yeah, we're gonna need you to go kill some we're gonna need you to go kill some.
You gotta go
kill some Iraqi people, okay? Go, like, we're gonna need you to.
Yeah, kill like a bunch of people right now.
Like, that's thing. Like, we were kind of like, we were messing with you. Like, you're gonna need to go do that.
Yeah. Anyway, Piskowski's his stance on equality.
I just think this guy is, like, in a weird place. I think they're asking this person to talk about this movie, and I think he's mentally in a very who knows what he was like before and after. He really seems like he's in a very transitionatory, like, very, like, uncomfortable place at the time that he's asked to talk about this.
I think
is my feeling. He just seems deeply uncomfortable and, like, unsure of his answers.
I think as far as the French ideals of equality, fraternity, and liberty are concerned, you and I would largely use those terms interchangeably.
Yeah, I mean, I would, you know, I can describe sort of different aspects of the same concept of
of
humanity.
They are right. They are dancing around the same circle. And we, you know, it's in much the same way that I use the terms liberation and salvation interchangeably when I talk about religion. But obviously, no doubt to the Enlightenment writers, the French Revolution was building off of, those terms, there's three words there because they do define them differently and probably at length. And perhaps Piskowicz is also coming from a place where he's defining them differently.
Yeah.
And, you know, I already talked about them being, you know, liberty being subservient to equality and neither of them working without fraternity is sort of a thing he explicitly says. And he says we'd all be in hell without the third installment, without fraternity, which does make me anticipate Red and look
forward to it more.
Yeah, I
mean, I think it's going
to
be an
interesting
to see
what they
watch,
do with this last
sure,
one.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think ideologically that is true if you are separating those into three different ideas.
Right.
fraternity is the capstone that you need. At least if you define fraternity the way he seems to be defining fraternity. As I said, care. Actual interpersonal relationships.
Well, and to me, like, that's sort of what we've been talking about quite a bit here, is this idea that, like, he still in some way feels some sort of commitment to this concept and this project as being, like, important or good. And I think he's running up against the contradictions that are inherent to it that, like, mean that, like, that anybody who is asked to think any sort of depth about the sort of state of the world runs into pretty quickly, right? Like, you run into this, like, well, now I have to reconcile some pretty serious contradictions, or else this is not going to work.
Yeah, I guess between the film scholars approaching these as apolitical works and Pissowitz approaching this having seemingly lost hope, just makes me sad.
I agree.
At the bonus features.
I went into the bonus features, like, I, broadly speaking, really liked White. I thought, like, yeah, I had my own conceptions of what White was saying.
The movie was great.
It was akin to exactly what you were saying. I was like, this is a very fun, this is a lot of fun for a movie that's condemning the rapid expansion of the concept of capitalism in Poland. During the fall of communism, and like the broadly speaking, the bonus features depressed me. I was like, oh no, nobody seems to like read the movie they made or were associated with in some capacity correctly. I found the one I found most depressing was, as I talked about, On White, the essay, the video essay was a depressing romp
Tony
through,
Rain's
like,
video
sort
essay
sort of self denial of like denialism of like just pretending that, like, the movie just says the thing you want it to say. Like, in a really...
Yeah.
That set the stage in many ways for me for, like, the other ones, because it put them into perspective, because it's the extreme interpretation of what is said in those other ones, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Rains's final sentence. Equality is a mirage. Few come anywhere near it. And most don't even really want it.
Yeah, that the
so
most don't even want it is,
ideals.
Like, is the most sort of like, it's taking what they're saying in their interviews to like 11. And it's this idea that like, oh yeah, people don't want equality. It's like, no, you've misunderstood like an inability to get it in a system that's not designed to allow them to have it with like not wanting it. Like, why does like, because like it doesn't ask the core questions. It's like really frustrating, right? Like, It sort of wants to, but it doesn't, right? Like, why does the guy at the end want 2 out of 5? Well, does he want it because people are inherently selfish and he wants the most for him? Or does he want it because they're all fucking being, like, he works in a job that probably doesn't pay him enough to, like, feed everybody and to, like, do what needs to be done in a system where the economy has literally just collapsed? That doesn't read to me as like, oh, this is human nature. It's inevitable that people want to fuck each other over. It reads to me as like, well, we created the conditions that will like incentivize literally everybody to be shitty to each other, because that's the only way to ensure that you will survive, and then for your family and everything else will survive. It's like, that's not universal. Yeah. You created the context, and the context dictates what will happen.
The interviews with our two leads were informative and delightful in their own right, but they're not talking about interpretation
necessarily.
In a much
more casual way. They're very just like, it's neat to learn how the directing went and stuff. And But it's very like, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's interesting that last week, Kieslowski was presented as a very collaborative filmmaker. And this week he's presented as more authoritarian from our actors. That's a little fascinating.
Well, I kind of wonder if it, like, to a certain extent, is a sort of situation where it's like, Kieslowski is what he needs to be to whoever he's directing. Like, in this situation, they especially, oh goodness, I've forgotten her name, the actress who played
Julie Delpy.
Julie Delpy describes, like, preferring a director who is a little more demanding and just sort of like says what he wants and just like, and like,
yeah.
And you kind of wonder, like, does he just, you know, to a certain extent, does Kozlowski just sort of respond to like the desires of his actors, where like, well, they, this, these people clearly prefer to be directed, so I will give them what they prefer. You know what I mean? Kind of, to a certain extent.
Yeah. And because, also, yeah. also in, also interesting to learn from her that, like, Juliette Binoche, last week, the star of last week's film, she also auditioned for Veronique in The Double Life of Veronique, and was passed over.
Well,
only
it was
to
very
be later
much, she very,
a different
very seemingly self-sabotaged it in some ways, right? Very much like,
yes.
Try to be sexy, and it's like, well, I'm going to like do something that's like the opposite of that.
Yes, like picking earwax.
Yeah, I don't like to act yeah. sexy on in that way, which is yeah. which is interesting because the role she ends up in here is in my mind more intensely that way than Blue was.
Right.
It's more a lighthearted yeah. movie, but she has to be more sort of aggressive and sexual than Blue is multiple
right,
times.
Right, but unlike Blue, unlike Veronique, unlike Blue, unlike Veronique, and unlike presumably Red, which has another female lead, this is also the smallest female part we've seen.
Right, that's
Kozlowski
true, and it's
so
very
far.
Reactive to what's happening with the male lead, right? Like, it's very...
Yeah.
Dependent
yeah,
on
one
the male
of,
lead. Yeah.
One of the stated reasons for the addendum, the final scene being shot months later, was to humanize her, to keep her from feeling like a total
right,
monster.
Right.
Which I don't think she did up until that point. Though obviously we also live in a world where the movie has been edited to build to that final scene.
Right, we don't know what it looked like before they did that, right? Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, I will say that, like, we do end up in a situation where I can see that, especially early in the movie. Like, as we go further on, it becomes...
Oh, yeah,
as we spend
yeah.
more time with Carol only, and we kind of forget, like, her opening scene, we don't have context for why she's, like, gonna burn the salon down to frame him for arson. You know what I mean? Like, we don't
right.
understand, like, it's seemingly an act of just emotional terror with no
right.
core behind it. Like it, I can see why they would need to like try to fix some stuff, because it's like if you just take it at face value, it's like, well, it seems like this is a we see Carol and we understand her to be a very like gentle, kind person throughout most of the movie, and it's like, but this person hates him enough to like want to frame him for arson.
I mean, it's her name is Dominique.
Yeah.
Dominion. Domination. Dominique. If anything, the first act, Dominique, if she is representative of France, it seems it is not France's relationship with Poland, but, say, France's relationship with Algeria or something.
Well, and that's why, instead of reading it as France's relationship
yeah.
with Poland, I would argue it's more like France's or like Europe's relationship with like the peripheral territories that like are
right,
going
right.
to maybe join the EU. Like this idea
yeah.
of like,
but
you know, this sort of like, we're welcoming you in, but like actually like we're not going to treat you as an equal in this
yeah.
arrangement.
Well, I mean the arson thing particularly is it's an oppressor saying, who are they going to believe?
Right, you know, right. That's true. And I don't think that, like, Kozlowski's trying to talk about Algeria or anything like that.
Oh, certainly not. Certainly
I think
not.
The argument is more that, like, who has all the power here? Like, you want to join the EU? You want to be part of Europe? Like, then you're going to do what we say. Like, and I don't think it's just France.
Right.
It's France's representative of...
right.
Of the powerful countries in the EU, the countries that actually control
right.
the EU, and the way they see all these sort of like secondary territories in the EU, right? Like they're
you
like bear in mind that like you know we have seen a lot more since then that like than the people who made this movie did,
right?
You know, we have been in we've gone to see like you know the way they've treated other countries in the EU that are in the EU that are not considered prime to the way that the EU like look at the way like the way that Greece was treated by the EU. Like all you need to know like well Greece is by the standards and ideas of the EU a peripheral country in the EU, right? Like it's
right.
one of these ones that isn't like important to the project in the way that like France and Germany are important to the project. It's one of the ones that needs to exist in the project to be exploited, not to be an exploiter.
Right. Yes, but I guess sort of my point is that the arson scene is particularly the representative of Western power saying to someone, all right, you can't or won't go along with what I want. You're a terrorist now.
Right. Yeah, that's true. But bear in mind that, like, that the Soviet bloc was treated that way too, right? Like, there was like the Soviet bloc had been othered for like 70 years or whatever as being like, well, they're not Europeans. They're not like us. Kind of like you know. Maybe not with exactly the same, you know, it's not obviously the same exact rhetoric, but it's not that dissimilar in sort of the way it, like, oh, well, you're not one of us kind of thing. And so we're going to treat you
with
a level of contempt that is not that dissimilar than the way we treat colonies and stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know, when you read stories about, like, shock doctrine and stuff like that, you're like, oh, this is like, treating this entire area as being like subhuman, as being like not worthy of like care or consideration.
Still a fun movie.
No, though. I mean I agree. I really enjoyed it. I thought the movie was a lot of, like I said, like from a purely artistic sort of like which would I like to see again? Like I mean, Blue
it's
was
not
just
as,
so
it's not as good as Blue,
intense, but like I really did enjoy it. I thought it was I liked watching it. I had a really good time. I really thought, oh wow, this is like a truly excellent movie, and I do like the element of humor in it is well executed. Like it comes off as being basically as Kieslowski described it. It's like, well, you're not gonna like be laughing out loud at this, but you are going to find it darkly humorous, and you're gonna enjoy it.
And also, I laughed out loud a couple of times.
There were a couple of times that were actually quite funny, but like
because I was home alone and could lean into it, but I did.
But in general, I found that I was like really enjoying myself. So,
yeah. Well, this week we've been talking about White from the Three Colors trilogy, directed by Krzysztof Kieslowski. Next week we'll finish up with Red. Kieslowski's final film, not just in the trilogy, but in life. He died a couple of years after it came out, at the age of 54, relatively young. But as his co-conspirator intimates, he seemed to have a pretty good idea that he was not long for this world.
Yeah, they kind of keep like relating that idea, and it's like whenever you encounter that kind of concept, it's always like. I don't know. It's like, it's just a really strange idea, but like, they like really like, oh, maybe he knew he was going to die soon. Like, maybe I could see it like, you know, with a year or two left, right? Like, he's quite tired all the time and kind of stuff. You know, maybe, I guess. You maybe don't know you're going to die, but like, certainly ready to withdraw from filmmaking, right? Like, he's already decided
I'm not
going to do this anymore.
It's not like he had tuberculosis.
You right, know, yeah, like that's what's interesting. Like we have been dealing up until now with people who like knew they were gonna die, like really obviously. Now, mind you, he was diagnosed with a heart condition, like what a year or so before he died. Most of his heart had ceased to function correctly. Like you know, maybe not know exactly when you're going to die, but you're like, well, this is probably not got, I probably don't have a long for this world, you know, might be a way to see that and understand that, where he's like, well, I mean, you know, it's not maybe like premonition, but it's like, well, this is not, I'm not in a good place here right now.
Right.
So,
yeah. Anyway, we'll pull this one to a close. Thank you so much for listening to Lost in Criterion. I'm, as always, the Adam Glass. With me, as always, John Patrick Owatari Dorkin. And we'll see you next time. Bye. Bye. You've been listening to Lost in Criterion with co-hosts The Adam Glass and John Patrick Owatari Dorkin. With the collapse of Twitter, who knows what social media we might end up at. How about Blue Sky? That sounds great. Check out the official podcast account at lostincriterion.bsky.social. Jonathan Hape does our music, and you can check out more of his work at jonathan-hape.com or on any music streaming service. And you probably should. He's pretty good. A big thanks to everyone who supports us on Patreon. You can join their ranks at patreon.com/lostincriterion. And hey, thank you for listening.